Hello there. Today is Tuesday, December 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the nation begins a week of mourning for the 41st President of the United States.
His example will always inspire, and his lifetime of service will be enshrined in the hearts of the American people forever.
President Trump calls for an end to an arms race with Russia and China. World leaders are gathering for a major climate summit with dire warnings for inaction. Also ahead, a couple of award-worthy movies just released. We'll have some reviews. It's all on today's International Edition.
He didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up.
Well, the casket carrying the remains of George H.W. Bush is at the U.S. Capitol as the nation begins its formal farewell to the 41st president. His remains arrived Monday afternoon at Joint Base Air Andrews outside Washington aboard an aircraft that often serves as Air Force One. Former President George W. Bush, the eldest of the four Bush sons, and his wife Laura, along with brother Neil Bush and his family, were aboard the plane for the trip from Houston. Bush died Friday in Houston at the age of 94. His remains will lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda until Wednesday morning. Following a short service Monday afternoon, Vice President Mike Pence offered the nation's condolences to the family of the late former president and thanked Bush's family for sharing this special man with the country and the world.
When President George Herbert Walker Bush left office, he left America and the world more peaceful, prosperous, and secure. President Bush was a great leader who made a great difference in the life of this nation. But he was also just a good man.
Bush's former Secretary of State and longtime close friend, Jim Baker, also spoke of the former president's humility.
He didn't blow his own horn. One of his wonderful character traits was to let other people take credit. That was something he was brought up with, and that's the way he operated. But he was an extraordinarily, if you think about it, you go back and look at the record, he was an extraordinarily consequential president of the United States, particularly in the arena of foreign affairs.
Well, joining us now is former VOA White House reporter Paula Wolfson, who covered the 41st president and is here to offer other insights. Thank you for joining us. George H.W. Bush was the first president you actually covered at the White House, correct?
I got to spend, they call it being a lifer on a campaign. When you're there from the primaries through the convention, through election night. And I had the great fortune to be assigned to be the VOA lifer on George H.W. Bush's presidential campaign. And you really get to know a future president by covering their campaigns. You get to know them when they come back to talk to you, when you happen to be one of the few reporters traveling on their campaign plane. You get to know them when they're tired, when they're cranky, when they're humped up in front of crowds. You get those unscripted moments a lot. And actually, one of the most interesting things that happened to me, the one thing that happened to me that made me think, wow, I've really arrived, was actually right after the election, but before he was inaugurated. In very typical George H.W. Bush style, he decided to hold a little Christmas party for about a dozen, maybe a few more journalists who had been the lifers on his campaign. I was fortunate enough to be invited. It was at the vice president's residence. It was incredibly casual. People in jeans, people in khakis, sweaters, wear your ugly Christmas sweater, that sort of thing, singing Christmas carols around the piano. And I got a chance to ask the president-elect to look into his crystal ball. And I said to him, you know, if you could look ahead in the next 4 years, what do you see? And I sort of imagined him to talk in, you know, great philosophical terms, or maybe about China, or maybe about, some domestic matter. And instead, he looked at me and said, you know, I predict there's going to be great change in Hungary. Hungary, I said. And he looked at me and said, well, Hungary and all of Eastern Europe. Mark my words, I'm just thinking that's where it's going to happen. And what happened on his watch? What changed history? the downfall of the Warsaw Pact, the downfall of the Soviet bloc, the downfall of the Soviet Union.
What about on a personal level? What was he like from your perspective of covering him?
You know, I've been talking to a lot of the other reporters that also covered Bush 41, and we all came up with about the same word. And the word is decent. He was a good, decent man. You didn't have to agree with what he did politically. You didn't even have to agree with some of the tactics he used during his campaigns. But the bottom line was he was a very decent man. Yes, a military hero. He had held all these high jobs within the government. But he was also a family man. He was a man who was very loyal to his friends. He was a very thoughtful man. Every day at the end of our shifts, those of us who were there late the day at the White House would go to the lower press office where the lower ranking press staff worked, right off the White House briefing room that you've seen on television. There was a door with glass panes in it that led out to the promenade between the Oval Office and the residence. And every night, without fail, every weeknight, between about 5:36, you'd see the President of the United States walking by, swinging his briefcase, just like your neighbor coming home from work. And he'd stop every night and talk to the reporters that were sort of gathered there at the door. And he'd open the door and he'd go, "Hey, how you doing? How's so-and-so? How's your kid? Did your kid get into the college he wanted to go to?" He knew us. He cared about us. He cared about people. And that's the kind of person he was.
And what was his relationship with the press?
Very different from what we have today. He talked about a kinder, gentler nation. Well, it was a kinder, gentler time when it came to relations between the president and the news media. A couple of things you got to remember were different, though. Back then, there was no real 24-hour news cycle. Cable news was just in its infancy. So reporters had time to really digest what happened before they would go out and report it. There wasn't this constant boom, 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 boom. You have to get the story. This was also before Twitter, before social media. And this was a president who wasn't tweeting all the time. Instead, he was doing the written word. He was doing letters. And his letters, well, it's kind of telling, Lori, that his first book, he didn't want to write an autobiography. He didn't want to write a book about his years in office. His first book was a book of those letters, and those letters are very, very telling. He wrote them to world leaders, but he also wrote them to everyday Americans that he managed to meet during his presidency.
Did you have any personal interactions with him that really stand out?
I love that story from the Christmas party. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that even though I was probably one of the newest reporters on the beat, he made me feel like I had always been there. He had nicknames for everybody,
really?
All the reporters. The tallest guy in the press corps was Stretch. Actually, the second tallest guy was Stretch. The tallest guy was Big Stretch. I was Red because of my red hair. He knew. He knew faces. He knew names. Great story. Ann Devroy, friend of mine from the Washington Post, was probably one of the toughest reporters in town. Died of cancer, about 10, 15 years ago. And the president really thought she had it in for him. But when he learned that she was ill, that she had been diagnosed, there was the letter from the president, you know, "You're a tough woman. You've always been tough around me, and you'll be tough with cancer." That's the kind of person he was.
All right, that's former White House reporter Paula Wolfson. An invitation-only funeral service is set for Wednesday at Washington National Cathedral. President Donald Trump is among the dignitaries who plan to attend. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Ukraine urges German naval presence in the Black Sea. The Taliban confirms a top commander has been killed by a U.S. drone. A new tool to fight cancer? Artificial intelligence. And the African Cup of Nations is looking for a new site for 2019. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump Monday said he'll discuss military developments with his counterparts from China and Russia in the future in the hopes of ending what he described as an arms race with those countries. In a tweet, Trump said there will be talks for a meaningful halt to what has become a major and uncontrollable arms race. Earlier this year, the administration publicly discussed quitting a landmark nuclear arms control pact with Russia that's been in place since 1987. Moscow, in return, warned Washington that if that happens, it will be forced to respond in kind to restore the military balance. if Trump carries through on the threat to pull out of the INF treaty. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with John Tierney, executive director for the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, for his perspective.
I think he's right that it's crazy that this country spent $716 billion, but he's as much to blame for it as anybody else. He signed the bill, and he didn't really come back with any alternatives, of which there are plenty. And if he's talking about an arms race that he seems uncontrollable, well, he's aiding and abetting that ability. He can certainly participate in controlling it. The United States always had a leadership role in doing that since the days of Ronald Reagan, and he and John Bolton and company have sort of abdicated that. So I think we should encourage him to have those conversations. We should think about it. The sooner it starts, the better. He ought to do it at a high level with people that understand what they're doing. That, you know, we have diplomats that have experience in this area, knowledgeable. He just can't go about it as he's been prone to do in the past, sitting down himself and thinking that the three principals are going to chat it out without doing an awful lot of groundwork and having a lot of people that are very, very knowledgeable about these areas get involved and start working on it.
Do you see a possible opening that would make the presidents of China and Russia amenable to such talks?
I do. Look, even back in the days when Ronald Reagan thought that Russia was the evil empire, and we had any number of disputes and disagreements with that country, that is the Soviet Union, they found a way to separate out the existential issue of nuclear weapons. This is a serious thing that can affect the humanity. So we have to be able to do that. And even though we have disagreements with Russia and some contention on trade and other issues with China, we certainly can carve out this issue, the existential threat of nuclear weapons and mistake or miscalculation or other things can go wrong, and start addressing those. And we ought to do that because it opens up a path to have conversations about a host of other things as well. But this is a serious matter, and most people who, in this country would love to see some serious negotiations to start to try to decrease the nuclear arsenals, and in fact, the entire arsenals of these countries, and start moving back to the path that we have been on for decades until more recently.
Isn't the president on record as advocating a modernization, not necessarily an increase, but a modernization of the nuclear program?
Look, he's on record. Some Democrats and Republicans are on record. China and Russia are on record. Other countries, France, are ready to talk about modernizing their arsenals. And the idea is, if you were talking about making sure that what you have as a deterrent is safe and secure, that's one aspect of modernization. And I think people can say, well, if you still believe in deterrence and that's your path, then you do want to make sure things are safe and secure. But if you're using modernization as a ruse to just have an arms race, to have more weapons of different components and different degrees of magnitude and move in that direction, then modernization is not what should be happening. So maybe the terminology to use instead of modernization is just securing and safe, making safe what's there is a deterrent, and then continue to negotiate, a decrease in the arsenals and finding ways to have communication between countries to lower the temperature of any disputes and start dealing with them diplomatically as opposed to making threats and building up your arms.
Mr. Trump's own Defense Secretary Jim Mattis warned just last week against Pentagon budget cuts in a speech in California.
Yeah, it's nonsense. Look, the military and the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke of, the minute they saw that the House majority was going to change and that people had a more progressive attitude towards our national security and a better way of ensuring our national security, they started to get itchy and they started putting out supposed reports about how we needed more money and Russia and China being the threats. I think the question of them is, how can it be that we have multiples of what we spent during the Cold War and we still go around claiming that, Russia and China are a problem, we may not be able to handle them? $716 billion is 10 times more than Russia rather spends on its defense and 4 times more than China spends on it. So either they're lying to us saying that, we have to really be concerned, we might not be able to stand up to them, or they've mismanaged that amount of money so desperately that heads on a roll at the Pentagon.
At the same time, Washington is considering pulling out of the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty because of Russian violations. Is this really a bad move at this time?
Well, Washington's not thinking of pulling out. Bolton and Trump are thinking of pulling out because they've never seen a multinational agreement that they like. And their whole philosophy goes against the grain, as I said, of every government official, Republican and Democrat, since the days of Reagan, which is to try to make multinational agreements work. And if you think somebody is violating, those agreements have mechanisms in there for trying to work out that disagreement. And Bolton and Trump have not even made the basis of efforts to try to get together with Russia and work out what they think is an agreement. They've alleged that Russia is violating it. Russia has alleged that the United States is violating it. But there is, I believe, clearly a path for them to sit down and resolve that dispute and keep Russia in the pact and have them be compliant and make sure that we comply with it. And then if they want to talk about bringing in China or other countries on the same subject at a later date, they can diplomatically do that as well. But to go around saying you just want to pull out of agreements, as Bolton does, who says he never had a prouder day than when he got Trump to pull out of the Iran agreement, be proud if he could pull out of the INF. He's not crazy about any multinational agreement, which is what lends itself to an arms race. So Trump, on the one hand, is bemoaning the fact that, oh my God, we might be in this uncontrollable arms race, then you ought to get rid of Bolton and stop that notion of people who don't believe in multinational agreements and get back into the mode of working on things diplomatically and working toward that end.
That's John Tierney, Executive Director for the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Delegates from 200 nations are in Poland, hoping to keep the world's attention on combating the potentially devastating effects of human-impacted climate change. But with global instability on the rise and the United States having withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord, progress is slow, as VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Global leaders are meeting in Poland for the most important set of climate talks since the Paris Accords in 2015. The meeting began on a somber note, with a warning from one of the world's preeminent naturalists.
Right now, we're facing a man-made disaster of global scale, our greatest threat in thousands of years, climate change. If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon.
But even in the host nation of Poland, known for its haze of winter coal smog, economic realities are forcing a less aggressive move away from fossil fuels.
It is necessary to create a development model which is going to reduce emissions while reducing poverty and creating new quality jobs at the same time.
In the home of the world's largest rainforest, Brazil's new government has said it will no longer host next year's climate talks and is calling efforts to reduce greenhouse gases a Marxist plot to stifle economic growth. In the U.S., officials, including President Trump, dismissed the scientific consensus that human activity is warming the planet. But experts who study climate change say doing nothing will actually have a devastating economic impact over time.
Climate change is here, it's real now, and the costs are large and they're mounting. I mean, they could reach $100 billion in some sectors by the end of the century.
And even though many nations are stalled in their efforts, researchers say they are seeing a growing consensus to curb climate change on the local and corporate level.
I think there's a mainstream understanding in the finance and business community now that that climate change poses a systemic risk to the global economy and that companies really have to get ahead of it.
Even if movement is slow, there remains consensus to do something because, as one conference participant was quoted as saying, there is no plan B. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
President Donald Trump has returned home from the G20 summit, meeting of the world top economies. After the curtain came down on the summit, though, the spotlight lingered on the leaders of the two top economies. As VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports from Buenos Aires, in the end, China and the United States did agree to put the escalating dispute over tariffs on hold and give negotiations a chance.
During a 2.5-hour sirloin steak dinner in Buenos Aires, U.S. President Donald Trump and his Chinese counterpart discussed their differences on trade that had led them in past months to exchange significant retaliatory tariffs. President Xi Jinping noted it had been a long time since the two had last met, and a lot of things have taken place.
Only with cooperation between us can we serve the interest of world peace and prosperity.
Trump predicted his relationship with Xi would lead to a breakthrough.
And I think at some point we are going to end up doing something which is great for China and great for the United States.
The Buenos Aires meeting resulted in a truce in their trans-Pacific trade war, with both countries agreeing to halt additional tariffs on each other for 90 days while they talk, and China is pledging to boost purchases of products from the United States. Steve Herman, VOA News, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On our voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Energy experts are urging Africa to use more of its gas reserves to fuel economic development. The group gathered in Washington to discuss the role of natural gas in helping to meet the continent's electricity, health, and environmental goals. The meeting coincides with the release of a report funded by Africa 50, which includes the Africa Development Bank, two African central banks, and 27 African countries. Since its creation 2 years ago, Africa 50 reports it's financed solar plants in Nigeria and Egypt and a thermal plant in Senegal. VOA correspondent Mariana Diallo has more.
In the new report, energy experts say there's tremendous potential for exploration and production of the vast natural gas reserves on the continent. Alain Eboubissé, CEO of Africa 50, talked about the findings at Washington's Atlantic Council.
In Africa, we have over 7.5% of the world's known gas reserves, and we're sitting on this bonanza.
He tells VOA that Africa 50 shareholders have committed $850 million so far to rev up the energy industry.
Africa has to use a bit more of its gas reserve to fuel its economic development. And I believe that Africa 50, working with other investors, can invest in those midstream, downstream gas pipelines, gas distribution networks.
As the African population continues to grow and the continent's economy continues to expand, the energy sector must keep with supply demands now and into the future, experts say. Former U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz is president of Energy Futures Initiative, which wrote the report.
In terms of the climate and the environmental impacts, the reality is that Africa today uses about 45% coal and oil for electricity. Electricity use is going to grow dramatically. If that grows with coal, it will be very, very bad in terms of carbon footprints.
But Moniz says maximizing the potential of natural gas doesn't exclude the development of renewable energy sources as well.
I believe that natural gas deployment will support renewables deployment. The real challenge, finally, is going to be how do we co-develop the gas markets and the gas infrastructure to satisfy the needs of these growing economies.
Eboubissé says private sector investment will be needed to meet growing demand.
The game changer today is that there is a consensus among policymakers that they need to do the right thing to attract private investment, because everybody understands that public investment is not enough to bridge that infrastructure gap in the gas space.
Andrew Kamau with the Ministry of Energy and Petroleum in Kenya urges policymakers to move quickly.
Don't forget, capital has a shelf life. If it's not welcome in your country, it will go somewhere else. If you can make decisions quickly as a government and as the bureaucracy, you will attract more people to your country to invest.
Meanwhile, experts say the continent's vast potential remains untapped. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
This is Science in a Minute.
On August 21, 2017, a total solar eclipse followed a northwest to southeast path across the United States. A number of researchers from various scientific disciplines used the solar eclipse to conduct experiments. Researchers at the University of Missouri put together a group of citizen scientists along with elementary students and their teachers to study how a solar eclipse affects bees. 16 acoustic monitoring stations were placed along the total eclipse path in Oregon, Idaho, and Missouri. The monitoring stations were placed in locations where bees would congregate, such as flower patches. As the total eclipse made its way over each monitoring station, the researchers listened for the sound of bees buzzing, or as they found out, not buzzing. During the periods of totality, the bees took a break from their daily routines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, turning now to the latest Hollywood movies to come out in theaters, we are joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, so let's start with Favorite, starring Emma Stone. This is a different kind of a film.
Well, The Favorite is from director Yorgos Lanthimos, Greek director, who gave us The Killing of a Sacred Deer and The Lobster. Very unusual filmmaker, but he has just been on fire lately. This is a wild, entertaining, bracingly cynical comedy of royal manners. It's a total farce. It's about 18th century England is at war with the French, and they're having duck racing, pineapple eating. This is a look inside the royal palace. And the frail Queen Anne occupies the throne, and her close friend, Lady Sarah, she governs the country behind her. She's pulling all the strings because Anne's ill health and her incredible temper. But they have a new servant that arrives, Abigail, who's played by Emma Stone. She starts to charm not only the queen, but also Sarah takes her under her wing, but of course she's looking to advance herself in society, and it's all about backbiting, it's all about razor wit, it's about ridiculous women warriors with uncompromising strength, but they're also very vulnerable. So you've got Emma Stone playing Abigail and Rachel Weisz playing the Lady Sarah. It is absolutely just one of those period movies that's got a bite to it. So this is very, very popular with the critics, and best of all is the lady who plays the queen. She is just absolutely Olivia Colman. She plays Queen Anne. Watch out for her for an Oscar nomination. She was phenomenal. And Nicholas Hoult, who played in as a child in Love Actually, plays one of the lords in the movie, and he's absolutely hysterical. So yeah, definitely check out The Favorite. Everyone's going to be talking about it, and it wouldn't be the Hollywood award season without a period piece, and this one delivers all the laughs, all the excitement, and all the nastiness that goes on behind the scenes in the Royal Palace.
Sounds fascinating. And then we've got Julia Roberts making a comeback of sorts, not that she ever left, but we haven't really heard much about her, what she's doing lately. She's got a new movie now. Ben is back, and she plays a mother of undying love for her son in a very tumultuous situation.
Yeah, it's 19-year-old Ben Burns returns home for the holidays on Christmas Eve, but he's been in rehab for the last couple of years, and he is one of those drug addict teenagers that, you know, stole, sold drugs, endangered his family, endangered himself, dealt with organized crime. So he shows up at home on Christmas Eve, but her mom and her family are very wary of her son's claim to be clean for 77 days. So now the movie takes place over 24 hours. New truths are revealed. She shows her undying love for him, but it's put to the test because now she's dealing with her other family members, her new husband, and they have bent over backwards for this kid. And someone breaks into the house and steals their dog, and one of his old drug dealers knows he's back in town. So the movie is, again, like we had Beautiful Boy a few months ago with Steve Carell and Timothy Chalamet, about a family going through drug addiction. So here's another one where a mother, she was in denial, but now she will not take her eyes off her son. He doesn't spend any time alone. It just shows you what families are going through when the drug crisis right now. It just brings it home. So many people are going to be able to identify with it.
Really?
So yeah, Julia Roberts is phenomenal. Also, Peter Hedges wrote and directed the film. His son, Lucas Hedges, is one of the stars. He's the drug addict. So it's a family affair. So it's an amazing drama. It really is.
You've been listening to International Edition. That was Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thanks so much for joining us today, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA.